Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network. I'm Michelle Masurgeon, broadcasting from my home.
And I'm Alexis Goldsmith, and I am lucky enough to be in the studio at the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. Up first on tonight's program, Lynn Jackson of Save the Pine Bush reports on the public hearing held last night for the draft environmental review submitted by Pyramid Corporation, owners of Crossgate Mall, to develop 46 acres of pine bush lands.
Then, talking about ways to maintain recovery, sobriety, and how to find connection and support in these challenging times with Diane Cameron, author of the book, Out of the Woods, A Woman's Guide to Long-Term Recovery.
And after that, we continue our conversation about China and the COVID-19 crisis and the new Silk Road that China is building with Kevin Zies of PopularResistance.org.
Finally, outdoor farmers market matter more than ever. Troy Waterfront Farmers Market is back. We'll hear from Steve Ryder, manager of the market.
But first, we have headlines for you. The New York Times reports that Governor Cuomo, during the hectic days of late March, secretly slipped into the state budget a measure which was lobbied for by industry representatives that shields nursing homes from many lawsuits over their failure to protect residents from death or sickness caused by the coronavirus. Now, weeks later, more than 5,300 residents of nursing homes in New York are believed to have died from the outbreak, and their relatives may not be able to pursue legal action against the home's operators over allegations of neglect.
A state judge on Wednesday upheld the constitutionality of New York's landmark law that lifted the statute of limitations on sexual abuse claims from years ago. The court rejected a bid by the Diocese of Rockville Center to dismiss 44 lawsuits filed against it under the Child Victims Act.
The Cuomo administration has yet to decide whether to waive performance review requirements for teachers and school principals more than a month after the state education department went public with the request to do so.
Albany County has taken a step backwards towards reopening the local economy as the number of COVID hospitalizations has ticked upwards. One issue raised by Albany County officials is how nursing homes should be counted in determining progress in reducing the pandemic. Cuomo, however, said that the North Country is now one of four regions able to start reopening on Friday.
The Daily Gazette reports that African Americans constitute 12.4% of the population of Schenectady, though 28.6% of new positive COVID-19 cases discovered at the mobile sites. The emerging disparities are not being openly discussed by local officials, which worries the Schenectady NAACP. African Americans are predisposed to diabetes, hypertension, and kidney disease, all factors that increase their vulnerability to the virus. Long-standing disparities in inner-city communities have reduced access to healthcare, insurance, and preventative screenings, with a higher rate percentage of essential workers are minorities.
Since the beginning of the pandemic, rates of household food insecurity have doubled, and the rates of childhood food insecurity have quadrupled, as reported from the New York Times. The Agriculture Department has issued 2-month regulatory waivers, many of which expire at the end of the month, giving states more administrative power over the agency's 15 nutrition assistance programs, which cover children, women and infants, and adults. The USDA also plans to send more than 5 million food boxes a week to children living in rural areas who would have difficulty getting meals still distributed at many schools. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy.
You can learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media by visiting us online at mediasanctuary.org. And you can get in touch with us through email at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or follow us on Instagram or Twitter at Media Sanctuary and on Facebook at facebook.com/mediasanctuary.
On Wednesday night, the town of Gilderland held a virtual public hearing on the draft environmental impact statement prepared by the Pyramid Corporation, owners of Crossgates Mall, on the Rapp Road Residential Western Avenue mixed-use redevelopment projects. The proposed project would develop rare inland pine bush habitat that is home to endangered species. We talk with Lynn Jackson of Save the Pine Bush.
We're speaking with Lynn Jackson of Save the Pine Bush. We're here to talk about the public hearing that took place in the town of Gilderland on Wednesday night on the draft environmental review for the Rapp Road Residential Western Avenue mixed-use redevelopment. Welcome to the show, Lynn.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Can you tell our listeners what this public hearing was about?
So last night, there was a virtual public hearing at the town of Gilderland on the environmental review for this enormous project in the town of Gilderland. The project consists of three sites. The first site is proposed to have over 300 apartment units, and it is adjacent to the Pine Bush Preserve. And it itself is certainly has pine bush soils on it and pitch pine trees. And it is a really important piece of land. The other two sites, one is a proposed for a Costco, and the other one is the undefined. So it's a huge development. This is proposed by Pyramid Crossgates. And we believe at Save the Pine Bush that this development should not be built. The pine bush itself is a unique ecosystem that's located between the city of Albany and the city of Schenectady. It's located in the towns of Gilderland, Colony, city of Schenectady, and of course the city of Albany. It is a beautiful ecosystem of rolling sand dunes with dominant species of pitch pine trees and scrub oak. It is the home to the endangered Karner blue butterfly, which were almost extirpated from the pine bush a number of years ago. It is the home of many rare and threatened species. The pine bush is also a stopping off point for migratory birds. And there are amphibians and reptiles that live here that may not live anywhere near here. It is a beautiful, beautiful ecosystem. Say the pine bush started 42 years ago, and our only mission is to try to protect the Albany pine bush. The issue with the pine bush is that the pine bush ecosystem itself, some of it is in preserve, which means that the land has been purchased and either and the state of New York owns it, or it is privately held. People can have, there's a lot of private landowners in the pine bush, and their land happens to be pine bush ecosystem, but it is privately owned. So it is that kind of land that we're always looking at, because it is always under threat of development. That people can, theoretically do what they want with their land, and they can develop it. The land that we're looking at right now is really important. It's a really complicated part of the pine bush. There are many residences there. There's a lot of businesses there. But in amongst all of this is the pine bush ecosystem. And we really need to protect our ecosystems these days. The pine bush is considered the best example of an inland pine barrens ecosystem in the world. So it's a really special place. So I think it takes a great deal of consideration of, should we pave this over and put parking lots and apartments at a Costco there and gas stations? Or should we protect this beautiful land and keep it for posterity in the condition that it should be in, of pine bush?
So can you talk about the draft environmental impact statement that has been accepted by the town of Gilderland as complete?
In order to build a development as large as this, Crossgates, the Pyramid that owns Crossgates, needs to go through an environmental review. Now, there's some pretty serious issues with the environmental review. The first is that when this project was proposed in December of 2018, the project was much smaller. The project only consisted of 20 acres of land to build apartments on. There was no proposal for a Costco and no proposal for an unnamed development. So what happened is we went through what's called the SEQRA process. So SEQRA, S-E-Q-R-A, or the State Environmental Quality Review Act. Now that provides a way for local municipal bodies to review projects to see if there should be mitigation measures or if they should be built or if there's any environmental issues with it. The SEQRA process has a process to select what's called the lead agency. The lead agency is the municipal body. They're the ones that approve or disapprove the project. So in the town of Gilderland, when the proposed project was a 20-acre apartment complex, the lead agency was designated as the Town of Gilderland Planning Board. But between the time of the lead agency status being determined and the beginning of the drafting of the environmental impact statement, the project more than doubled in size. So added to the 20-acre apartment complex proposal was a proposal for a Costco and the undetermined proposed land. So instead of 20 acres, it's now 46 acres. Say the Pine Bush believes that it's pretty outrageous that the Town of Gilderland Planning Board is the agency going to make this review, because this project will affect people that live in Albany, not just in Town and Colony. And of course, it does really impact on the Pine Bush. And we believe another lead agency should be chosen for this project. So getting on to the draft environmental impact statement, this is a very large document. The actual narrative for the draft environmental impact statement is about 160 pages long. And then it has many, many appendices, almost 2,000 pages of appendices. Now, our biggest concern is for the environment. You know, Save the Pine Bush, we are concerned very much about the environment and what impacts this might be. So last night's hearing was to listen to people's concerns or objections or comments regarding the draft environmental impact statement. And people from Save the Pine Bush made quite a few comments last night. These comments included things. We have a butterfly expert, Dr. Cynthia Lane, and she called in last night and expressed her concerns about what is called mitigation measures. So theoretically, when you propose a development like this and you really want to have it built, maybe you'll give something back to the environment so that you can have your project built. So what CrossGates is proposing to do is to Pyramid CrossGates owns a lot of land around CrossGates Mall, a lot of land. And they own it under many, many, many different corporate entities. But one of the pieces that they own is about an approximately 8-acre site that is north of the mall. And it's north of the mall and it's located in the city of Albany. So Pyramid CrossGates is proposing that to mitigate the destruction of this 46-acre parcel development, that they would give this 8 acres of land to the Albany Pine Bush Preserve Commission for the preserve. Now, this land, this 8-acre site, is currently pine bush. I mean, it functions as pine bush. If you go to it, it's got pitch pine trees and it looks like pine bush ecosystem. So what they're proposing to do is give land that's already pine bush and destroy 46 acres of land for their development. And we think this is pretty outrageous, because what kind of mitigation measure is it if you are going to be destroying so much land? So many people called in last night. I didn't count the callers, but my estimate is that probably more than 100 people called into the virtual public hearing. Unfortunately, not everyone who called in for whatever reason, due to technical issues, was able to speak. There were at least a half a dozen calls where the planner Mr. Ken Kovalchuk, who answered the calls. He clearly, that the person, for whatever reason, did not respond. So we do, and I know of people now that tried to call in and were put on hold for a long time, and their phone, their call was never answered. I realize that this is during the pandemic, so technical problems are difficult. But if the town is going to hold a hearing on a project that is so big and is going to affect the town for decades to come, I think that everyone should be heard at a public hearing. And I don't believe that that's what happened last night. I'm pretty convinced that a number of people were left off and were not able to participate in the hearing.
So, Lynn, when is the vote on this project? And does the town of Guilderland, have they indicated in any way that they may vote?
We're at the draft environmental impact statement part of the project, which means, so right now, the next deadline is May 26th. If people want to make comments about the draft environmental impact statement, they need to get their comments in by May 26th. At that point, the ball goes back into the court of Pyramid Crossgates, and they need to respond to the comments made on the draft environmental impact statement, made by the comments both written and oral at the hearing. And they need to prepare a final environmental impact statement. And at that point, once the final environmental impact statement is prepared, the town planning board can accept or reject the environmental impact statement at that point. And if they accept the environmental impact statement, then at their next meeting or so, they can accept or approve the plan or deny the plan. I can't predict the future. I have no idea what the board intends to do. The comments last night, to me, the people in opposition of the project made very substantial comments about the inadequacies of the review of the vegetation on the property, the vegetation, the plants, the animals, soil conditions, that there are many issues, environmental issues, that the draft environmental impact statement simply did not address. However, you know, there's a lot of people who like to see development. So I could not predict what would happen. However, in the middle of all this, an attorney has filed a lawsuit for his client. And the attorney's name is Jim Bacon from New Paltz. And he filed an Article 78 in federal court over the lack of due process with the seeker process. He represents both residents in the town of Guilderland, plus a local business owner owns a gas station. And his lawsuit was triggered because on March 26th, the town of Guilderland allowed the developer to clear cut the property where the Costco is proposed. Now, when you're in the middle of the seeker process or the environmental review process, it is not legal to alter the site. You can't go in and alter the site during the environmental review process. And when you go in and clear cut trees, that is clearly altering the site. So Mr. Bacon's lawsuit is about changing the lead agency of the town of Guilderland for this review, saying that they allowed this clear cut to happen and that we need to stop the seeker process and start over again with a different lead agency. So how long will it take for the town to approve this? Well, it depends on many factors. The Pyramid Crossgates needs to prepare a final environmental impact statement, and we need to see what the results are with Mr. Bacon's litigation in federal court.
Do we know how many acres were clear cut?
The site itself, the Costco site, which is the site where it is proposed to build a Costco, is about 16 acres in size. But I don't know exactly how much of that was clear cut. Part of the Costco site actually has houses on it. Over the past 10 or 15 years, Pyramid Crossgates has bought the houses in that neighborhood. This is a neighborhood between Western Avenue and the Crossgates Mall itself. And they have left many of those houses vacant. It's kind of like a ghost suburb. So part of that, the Costco property, is these ghost houses with the suburban town-owned streets. And but it is quite a substantial size woodland. Some of the trees were very large that were cut down. Some of the trees cut down were pitch pine, which is, of course, the dominant species in the pine bush. So it was pretty substantial. It was many, many acres.
I saw an op-ed in the Altamont Enterprise about this project, asking why Pyramid Crossgates would want to build a new building when there are vacant buildings available. Do you want to respond to that?
Well, I think this is an issue that we should all be looking at, is that we all, you know, what do we do with these large buildings? You know, we're in the middle of this is a pretty serious pandemic. And how soon are people actually going to be willing to or want to go back to a place like Crossgates Mall, which is a very large, very, very large building? And it seems to me that we, instead of destroying unique ecosystems, what we really should be doing is reusing the buildings that we've already built. And we don't really know what's going to happen when society, quote, goes back to normal. I'm not sure when normal is going to happen, but it seems quite likely that a number of the large retailers are not going to financially survive the this very distressing time in our economic, you know, situation here. So it seems to me that rather than leaving large parts of the mall empty, it makes sense to renovate or change the mall so it could accommodate Costco, because then we wouldn't have to pave more asphalt, destroy more more pine bush, to destroy the homes of more animals, and it would be a good thing all around. And I think it's something that we really should look at, is preserving and protecting the pine bush in this way by reusing buildings. I mean, one of the commenters last night, I thought he made a lot of sense, is that, you know, they want to build all these townhouses. Well, you know, if you look at the inner cities of Albany, Schenectady, and Troy, we have a lot of abandoned buildings, and it would make much more sense to build, to renovate those buildings or build downtown. Now, I know Crossgates, you know, they probably don't own land, say, in my neighborhood in downtown Albany, which has too many vacant buildings. But, you know, as a society, we need to look at this instead of abandoning places in our inner cities and building farther and farther out, thus destroying more and more environment. What we really need to do is come up with a method so that we can save or reuse those parts of the city and leave our wild places wild.
Lynn Jackson, we're out of time. This has been Lynn Jackson of Save the Pine Bush. We've been discussing a public hearing that took place in the town of Guilderland on Wednesday to discuss the draft environmental impact statement prepared by Pyramid Crossgates. Lynn, the next date is May 26th for comments on the draft environmental impact statements. Where do people go to make comments?
So people should go to the town. The website is thetownofguilderland.org, and they can look at all the documents there. If people would like more information, go to savethepinebush.org, go to the Save the Pine Bush website, or you can email me at pinebush@mac.com. And we would be very happy if people are interested in this issue. We'd like to get a lot more substantial comments in by May 26th. People really need to take a look at, you know, what is development going to look like in this time of pandemic, and how, and shouldn't we encourage people to reuse buildings rather than destroying important ecosystems and paving it over?
Thank you, Lynn.
Thank you.
And that was my interview with Lynn Jackson of Save the Pine Bush. We were talking about the proposed 46-acre redevelopment, or rather development, in the Albany Pine Bush land. That development is proposed by the Pyramid Corporation, which owns Crossgates Mall. The deadline for public comment on the draft environmental impact statement is due May 26th.
Diane Cameron, author of the book Out of the Woods, A Woman's Guide to Long-Term Recovery, is up next, and she'll be speaking and sharing the issues recovering women struggle with most, from complacency to burnout to menopause to weight gain, and among all of it, how to handle the trials of double-digit recovery. On this interview with Diane, she'll talk about ways to maintain recovery, sobriety, and how to find connection and support in these changing times. By HMM correspondent Eileen Javier.
Hello, this is Eileen Javier for WOOC 105.3 FM in Troy for the Hot Zone Mohawk Magazine. And I am here with Diane Cameron discussing her book, Out of the Woods, A Woman's Guide to Long-Term Recovery. Welcome back, Diane, to the Hot Zone Mohawk Magazine. How are you?
I'm good, Eileen. I'm very happy to be back.
And we are happy to have you. In your book, you speak about the rules of the 12 steps programs and how these steps were able to help you maintain recovery and sobriety.
Absolutely.
For people in recovery in this moment, how do they do it, especially now that they can't go into a meeting or go into a church or go into a physical place to acknowledge the issues that they have in with an addiction?
That's right. And it is, when this began, we're now about 2 months into this new way of life. And one of the things that I have to say, I'm very sort of proud of the 12-step community because they adapted very, very quickly from going to maybe church basements or community centers to go to meetings. There are now millions of meetings available on Zoom, on the telephone, on webinar conferencing, using every technology. Every city, like right now in the capital region, there are probably, at least 50 meetings a day and hundreds of meetings every week that people in 12-step programs can participate in.
So they move to an online platform to be able to reach out people where they are.
Absolutely. It's more important than ever because, I mean, all of us, you know, in recovery or not, there's a lot of pressure right now. We're all feeling the isolation, the loneliness, the fear, financial fears for everybody in the United States. And then some people are living alone. That's hard. Some people are living with their loved ones, and that can be hard. So if you're a person in recovery, whether early and trying to figure it out, or you've been around for a while, all those other pressures are still there. So attending meetings has always been the core of recovery, and that continues for people, men and women.
And what about people that, because of the fact that they are isolated, that they have a problem with alcohol or with a drug,
right,
and they just find out now, in this time, just because they are all alone, and they just said, okay, wait, I might have an addiction. What
right.
do you think a person could do in this specific time?
That's an excellent question, because it's changed a little bit because of the circumstances we're dealing with. But I also think the acceleration of learning that you have an addiction is, in a weird sense, is better right now. But then the scary part is, what do you do when you can't leave the house and you're facing maybe this new information about yourself? Or maybe somebody at home is looking at you saying, holy cow, like, I didn't know you had a problem with that. Like, we better talk. You know, gambling happens right now without casinos. It happens online, things like that. Maybe looking at somebody and saying, geez, I think there's a problem here. Let's deal with it. The answer is also going to be reaching out for resources, using the internet, using Google, using some of this technology, because every community, and this is, thank you, Google, you can Google AA Albany, AA Capital Region, Gamblers Anonymous near me, and you'll get lists of meetings. Every 12-step program is organized around what's called an inner group, which is like the conference part. And you can get phone numbers, you can get meeting lists, you can ask to talk to an individual. Also, mental health providers are skilled in screening somebody for an addiction. And those services are free now. Therapy is free now from many healthcare providers. So you can call your doctor's office and say, can I talk to somebody? Now, again, not everybody's comfortable with that. You want something a little bit more anonymous or a little bit more private, and you reach out to a 12-step program and say, can you connect me to a woman? Can you connect me to a man so that it's comfortable, and get connected to a meeting to do that?
Okay. And there is a part in the book that you said that sometimes people tend to drop one vice for another one.
Absolutely.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. And that's something, the term is transferring addictions, and that applies to people new in recovery and people, you know, with very long recovery under stress. You know, maybe somebody's hasn't taken a drink in 30 years. And right now, under these circumstances, they notice that they're eating more, or they're tempted to go back to smoking. They haven't done that in years. And a lot of times, what is the centerpiece of transferring addiction is not wanting to feel feelings. You know, one of the solid theories around addiction is a way not to feel. So we may go from exercise to alcohol to drugs to shopping. It's about telling the truth. And this is where both meetings and sponsorship are important. Having other friends in recovery where you can kind of tiptoe up to the conversation and say, hey, I'm spending money. I'm not even leaving the house, but I'm doing a lot of shopping. I think something's going on. Let's talk it through. And let people in on both secrets and behaviors, you know, and that's how we use our friends in recovery. That's how we use our sponsors in recovery. And then every recovery program also has its own literature. AA has the big book, OA, NA, they all have literature. And if you've got that in your house with you, take it down from the shelf and start reading and talking to a sponsor and doing that kind of thing.
And what are things that people should be careful now?
I think that's also a very good question. The things to be careful for are people may have their adult children at home with them, and adult children bring their behaviors into our house, and it might be drugs or alcohol or gambling. They may or may not have a problem, but they're bringing their substances and their behaviors into the house. So we have to pay special attention to who's in the house with us, what are they bringing in with us, and what are we going to do about it?
Okay. In your book, you have spoken about how you achieve your recovery and your sobriety. Yeah. And give a story, very personal story, of what worked out for you. And I wonder, can you help a person change their behavior? Always have to come in from their own choosing.
That is an excellent question, because, and I think the answer, it's sort of a hybrid. I think if any of us think about anything in our lives that we've changed, something bothered us. You know, in recovery, we talk about hitting bottom, but hitting bottom doesn't have to be a disaster like losing a job. It can just be getting really uncomfortable with yourself. And then at the same time, if there are people in your life, or maybe books come into our lives at different times, and that intersection can be the moment of change. I'm uncomfortable about some behavior of my own. All of a sudden, I see a book that's about that very behavior. I tend to think that's maybe a very spiritual moment of like the universe is saying to me, okay, Diane, you want to change this? Pick up this book or talk to this person, or someone that you haven't met before discloses that they're in recovery. And now you've got somebody to ask questions. So I think the person who has the problem has to have some willingness, and then the people or the materials around them are the support for that.
Okay. And what about relapsing? Relapsing in this moment might be detrimental for the whole recovery process.
That's absolutely true. And it's one of the places, it's an area of vulnerability. It's testimony to how committed someone is to their recovery and the work that they do, even in, you know, COVID-19 times. Are we staying in touch with people? Are we talking to a sponsor or friends in recovery? Are we listening to TED Talks on recovery? Are we reading the books that we have? Are we watching movies about recovery? All of that is like, it's like exercise. It's like working out. You want to have strong recovery so that when the fears come, when the isolation comes, when the nervousness comes, the first thought is not, I'll eat a cake or I'll take a drink. But the first thought is, I don't feel well right now. I better use one of my tools of recovery.
And sponsors will be available online and via phone?
Absolutely. A lot of times people have, they had a past relationship with a sponsor, but one of the things, and I'm seeing this now because we're 2 months into this new sort of isolation and quarantine, is people are coming in new to 12-step programs, and they might notice somebody in a Zoom meeting or listen to somebody in a telephone meeting and think, that sounds like a person I could relate to. And then they can call them and say, would you be my temporary sponsor? You know, can you help me until I get my feet on the ground here?
The information is alanon.com.
That's right. And you can just Google Al-Anon or say Al-Anon near me or Al-Anon Capital District, and those meetings will pop right up.
Okay. There is anything else that you would like to add that I haven't asked?
Yeah. You know what, Aileen? One of the things I've been thinking about this that I think it's important for people to know is 12-step programs have been around since 1933. So we've been through, we people in recovery have been through a lot of difficult things, including war, Second World War, Iraq, Afghanistan. And for the most part, people stay in recovery. They stay sober. They stay abstinent. So there's a lot of muscle. There's a lot of strength in the program. And it's proof that practicing the principles of our programs, people stay in recovery. So we've got a lot of history to lean into there.
And where people can find your book?
They can find my book in the Capital Region at Market Block Books in Troy, at the Bookhouse in Albany, and of course online.
Okay. Thank you so much for giving me this interview and speak about your book and all the different ways that a person can maintain their recovery and their sobriety in these difficult times.
Aileen, I'm so happy to talk to you. Thank you so much.
And we just heard Diane Cameron, author of the book Out of the Woods, A Woman's Guide to Long-Term Recovery, with HMM correspondent Aileen Javier.
For those of you just tuning in, I'm Michelle.
And I'm Alexis. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or a sour bone to pick, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org.
Kevin Zeiss of popularresistance.org wrote a recent article, Pivot to Peace Must Replace U.S. Pivot to War with China. In part one, we discussed with Kevin China and the COVID-19 crisis and the new Silk Road that China is building. This is part two with Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
So we continue part two of our conversation with Kevin Zeiss of Popular Resistance. A recent article, A Pivot to Peace Must Replace United States Pivot to War with China. More recently, Trump has been escalating the conflict with China, allegedly over the COVID-19 crisis, saying, oh, maybe this was manufactured in some lab in China, and it got out, and China hid how serious a problem it was. And if they had spoken a lot sooner, you know, we wouldn't have so many deaths in the United States. What were some of the responses you had in your article to that line of contention?
Well, you know, the U.S. has actually put forward more than a dozen false claims blaming China, calling China not being transparent, not telling people soon enough, and even claiming falsely that it originated in the Wuhan lab. All this has been disproved. In fact, we mentioned that in the article on our newsletter on popular resistance, but we also have an article on popular resistance that called Reality Check that goes through each of these lies. And this is all part of manufactured consent for escalating the crisis. And the reality is that China told the World Health Organization in December when they first discovered an unusual pneumonia on January 3rd, China contacted the U.S. Center for Disease Control specifically to tell them about this unusual pneumonia and that might be a virus. China put out warnings. That CDC warning was then shared with the Department of Health and Human Services and the National Security Council. So the White House was aware of this on January 3rd. And here we are 5 months later. And the U.S. has still not put in place adequate testing or tracing. Just this week, China found 6 cases of COVID in Wuhan, 6 cases. And they announced that in the next 10 days, they're going to test every resident of Wuhan, a city larger than New York. That means 11 million people will be tested over the next 10 days in order to stamp out this small increase in cases. 6 cases, and they're going to do 11 million tests. The United States, in 5 months, has done 9 million tests. Inadequate. Trump's response has been inadequate from the beginning. It wasn't until mid-March that I finally took any serious action. The one step he took before that was to announce stopping flights from China. But the reality is China had already stopped flights out of Wuhan. So that was an inconsequential action. And we've learned since then that the virus actually came into New York through Europe, not through China. And so Trump has mishandled this virus terribly. The U.S. now has 1/4 of all the deaths from this virus in the world. 80,000 deaths. We'll have more than 100,000 deaths by the end of this month. Unless we make some major changes, we'll be in the multiple hundreds of thousands of deaths by the fall in the midst of the presidential election. So Trump is panicking. He's panicking because he knows that people will see how he mishandled this test. This virus, calling it a hoax, saying it'll be gone by April, saying the maximum deaths will be 60,000, on and on and on. He's made full inaccurate statements. So rather than accept responsibility, every time he's asked, do you accept any response? He says, no, I don't accept any responsibility. He instead is looking for a scapegoat, and that scapegoat is China. Now, China is a great scapegoat because since the Obama era, there's been a bipartisan effort to attack China. So a lot of false information about China has been put into U.S. press. The Hong Kong protests, which had been funded by the National Endowment for Democracy, the anti-China movement since the 1990s, the U.S. has been funding that. And so these anti-China protests that were pretending to be democracy protests were misreporting the United States. The allegations regarding the Uyghurs in the Muslim territory, another great exaggeration. Again, the U.S. has been funding the Muslim the Uyghur Congress in that part of China for more than a decade. So the U.S. has been fomenting problems in China and reporting them in the U.S. media to create an anti-China bias. So, of course, now you see Biden and Trump both trying to out-attack China each other. Biden saying Trump is weak, Trump saying Biden is weak. They're both wrong. We need to find the time. We need to move toward cooperation with China. We have global crisis issues, the pandemic, global economic collapse, the nuclear arms race, and of course, most important, the climate crisis. We need to unite together with China and other countries to confront these global issues. Instead of sowing division with anti-China falsehoods, we should be finding ways to de-escalate and work together and solve these common crises.
Now, at the end of your article, you point to a page, a petition, I believe called Pivot to Peace, right, which sounds, you know, very similar to what you just been talking about. Can you explain, you know, how has that arisen, and is that just the United States effort or more countries involved?
It's a global effort, and the Pivot to Peace began in the United States as Chinese groups were under attack. They started to form this, and now it's broadened out to other organizations and other people. Pivot to Peace is something people can all go to on the website. In addition to the petition, there's information about the escalation of conflict between the U.S. and China and how we have to de-escalate it. I think this is really something that, as we saw the pivot to war that started with the Obama administration and that now has turned into a national security strategy of great power conflict, it's essential for people in the United States to tell our country we want to see de-escalation and cooperation between the U.S. and China. These are the two largest economies in the world. If we're in conflict, it hurts the economic security and the military security of the world. We need to find a way to come together, work together to solve the common crises, climate change, nuclear escalation, the pandemic, and the global economic collapse, which is looking more and more like it could become a global depression. Because in addition to mishandling the virus, the Trump administration and Congress are mishandling the response to this economic collapse.
So we're talking with Kevin Zeese. You have about 3 minutes left. I'm sort of curious about how other, you know, countries in Asia and Pacific view, you know, China and its growing, you know, economic might. Certainly one of the things, at least in the Western press, has been pointed out, China's been quite aggressive about lending money to smaller countries to support development projects, but it gives them, you know, increased leverage over, you know, that country. Are other Asian countries concerned about the growing power of China?
Well, it's, you know, that's an interesting question because the U.S., of course, tries to foment division between other countries with China, particularly Vietnam, Philippines. And, of course, there's longstanding problems between Taiwan and China. As China sees that, Taiwan is actually, from their perspective, part of China and needs to become unified more closely with China. So there are conflicts. But the more important point, I think, about China is they are developing the Belt and Road Initiative, which goes through Asia, Middle East, Russia, Northern Africa, and Europe. And connecting Europe to Asia through that Belt and Road Initiative will be the engine of economic development for this century. As part of that effort, the Belt and Road Health effort in response to the COVID virus, China has been providing assistance to many European countries and Middle Eastern countries like Iran, and has been working to try to help countries to respond to the virus. China has shown a one way to respond to the virus effectively, and it's one that we could learn a great deal from. But they have been sending doctors, health supplies, not only to the Belt and Road Initiative countries, but even to the United States. They've been sending supplies. So they have been trying very hard to help countries respond to this terrible pandemic. But the Belt and Road Initiative is something that will be a key to the engine of the economy for the future. And it really threatens the United States because what it means is a European and Asian dominated 21st century with the United States cut out. The United States, instead of causing division, needs to figure out how to unify with China so it can join in building a green economy through the Belt and Road Initiative. That is a step that needs to be taken. Conflict will not help either China, U.S., Russia, or Europe.
So we've been talking with Kevin Zeese of PopularResistance.org. I know you have a daily newsletter people can sign up for, I assume, through PopularResistance.org.
That's right. On the front page of PopularResistance.org, you can see both our weekly and our daily news digest. The news digest, neither one of these have any charge. The article we've been talking about is our weekly newsletter. The daily news digest summarizes about 15 articles a day in 4 or 5 lines. You can then click on the article and get the full article. And we urge people not only to get the Daily Digest, but also when you see articles you agree with or are interested to you, share them widely. We have to be the media. People's media needs to become much more powerful. If we consciously work, like you're doing with this kind of your radio station, if we consciously work to be the media, we can overcome the misinformation of the corporate media and the bipartisan Wall Street parties in Washington, D.C. So sign up at the Daily Digest and our weekly newsletter and share the information widely.
Thank you, Kevin Zeese, PopularResistance.org. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio.
That was an interview with Kevin Zeese of PopularResistance.org on China's new Silk Road with Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Network.
And we close out the show with a segment on the farmers market. For those who prefer local farmers' green markets to shopping inside during the coronavirus outbreak, Hudson Mohawk correspondent Andrea Cunliffe talks with Steve Ryder, manager of the Troy Farmers Market, about its opening this Saturday and its rules introduced to keep the market safe.
Welcome to Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Yeah, sure. Hi, my name's Steve Riddler. I'm the manager of the Troy Waterfront Farmers Market.
And lots of good things are happening this weekend, I understand.
Yes, this weekend is the start of our unpausing, as we like to call it. We paused in March, just at the start of the COVID-19 restrictions, and now we're coming back out again a couple of weeks later than normal, but with a much reduced market size, a new location, and some more rules.
You have a new location on, is it First and Division?
We're going to be starting off in a Russell Sage parking lot on the corner of First and Division.
Well, that's great. It's an open air parking lot, isn't it?
Yep. It's all open, and the students aren't around, so there's plenty of space at Russell Sage, and we talked to them about partnering to get it up and running, and they're letting us start off in this smaller parking lot, and we'll get 25 vendors in there, and we'll have a one-way system, and there'll be all sorts of little rules and regulations, but in terms of people arriving in cars, there's a larger parking lot right next to it, so there's going to be plenty of parking for people.
So you have a reduced amount of vendors. Is that because you don't have the space, or because you're separated, or what?
Yep. So the way that we're trying to do this is to start off with a smaller number of vendors, so that we can have proper social distancing in a tighter area. The area is created the number of vendors based on the capacity of that space and the number of people that we want to get in there at any one time. So we worked with the county and the city to go through all the different regulations. And we looked at what other farmers markets were able to achieve that had remained open. And we decided that having 50 customers in at any one time should allow the social distancing to work. So we're signing people up. There's an online sign-up form on the Troy Market website at troymarket.org. And you get to sign up. You know, if there's some people who walk up, we've got some spare capacity to allow people to enter. And after we get through the first week, we'll see how well that worked in terms of social distancing, and maybe we'll be able to increase the capacity as we go forward.
So as you sign up, does it give you a time slot?
Yep, you get a time slot. When those time slots are gone, you look for a different time slot. So,
Do you have to stay in the market a particular period of time, or can you?
Well, we would like people to move through it quickly. We're not going to let anybody in until people have left. So, if people hang out there longer than normal, then it'll slow it for everybody else. But we'll be moving people along. It's really become more of a shopping experience than a festival and an entertainment location and a social gathering spot. No, it's really about going in, getting what you need, and moving along.
Oh, right. Because I know that a lot of people just feel claustrophobic in a supermarket under these conditions. And the idea of being able to be outside and shop within the confines of the farmer's market would be, kind of a relief, I think.
Yeah, no, and that's what we're hoping. We're trying to provide alternatives for everybody. I mean, the farmers market was always listed as an essential service, but we had to recognize that the Troy Market is a big regional draw, and we had to come up with a way to make it work safely for everybody, vendors, staff, and customers. And we think we've done that, and we think it's going to be a very attractive experience. Smaller numbers of vendors, but a good mix, a nice mix.
How did you select which vendors would be in this week, or would it be the same vendors each week, or will there be changes?
Yeah, well, right now we're going to start off with this core group of vendors, and then we're going to try and expand and add and see how that works out. But the vendors were selected based on who was available, who thought they wanted to be out there right now. Not all vendors are ready to go out into the fray. Some vendors don't necessarily have the crops yet right now, and some vendors don't really fall into the essential category. So we started off looking to try and provide as much of the different varieties of food groups as we could. So we've gone for vegetables, meats, dairies, baked goods, a little bit of some of the fancier stuff like the pestos and the honeys and things like that. So we tried to create a mix that would be very attractive to customers that would want to be able to get a lot of different things. And so we've done pretty well with that, given who was available and who wanted to come in. And we're hoping that once we get through the first week, we'll be able to show that we'll be able to get a few more people in. And so we do have a plan to expand over the next couple of weeks as vendors come back with product. It's been a cold spring, and so things are a little late getting ready for the early crops.
Will there be requirements that you wear a mask or that you bring your own bags or things like that? Will those be requirements for the customers?
Yeah, there's lots of requirements for vendors, customers, and what we've done is put those on our website, and anybody entering the market will need to have a mask on, and we'll have extra masks available. That's compulsory, and the vendors will all be wearing gloves. If customers want to wear gloves, that's up to them. We're not going to require that. There'll be hand sanitizers at every booth. There'll be a couple of hand sanitizer stations around the things, and we have a couple of little camping sinks with a rather nifty little touch-free disposable foaming soap container that will be there. So we'll have that opportunity, and there'll be no dogs allowed in the market.
Well, that's a disappointment.
Yep, that's a disappointment to all those dog owners, but it's just not possible right now to accommodate that.
So do we bag our own food when we go, or will...
So what we've done, even though we went to great pains to ban plastic and go to all reusable bags, we're actually taking the lead of everybody out there who is concerned about reusable bags, and we're not going to allow those into the market. It's going to go back to compostable bags from the vendors, from plastic bags from the vendors, or paper bags from the vendors. All products will be bagged by the vendor. Most of it will be pre-bagged if it needs to be bagged on site. The vendor will do that. So there's no handling of products by a customer. They will just point, and the vendor will provide them with that product in a bag, and they'll take it and move along. And, you know, that's the way it'll be for a while.
Well, I know we're all looking forward to having the market open again, and hopefully you'll be able to make it really comfortable and fun to be there once again. But I take it there won't be any food, or there won't be any edible, you know, like luncheon or prepared
no,
foods.
No, so from the entertainment standpoint, you know, obviously there's no music, there's no chairs, there's no sitting, you know, there's nothing to force you to loiter. We do have two prepared food vendors in the market this week. They're just as essential in terms of, you know, the takeout type approach. And they'll be doing food to go. Some of it will be frozen. Some of it will be warm but ready to go, packed up and off you go. Pre-order. A lot of the vendors will be doing pre-ordering through their own websites directly with them. And they will also be able to take orders right there for the food. And it'll be packed up and off you go.
Do you have a delivery service also? Will that be there?
No, there's no deliveries from our market. But what we do have is our new online service that we've opened up. We've been running it for two weekends now. And that's, you go online, sign up, and go to a virtual grocery store, farmer's market, essentially. All the vendors are there. You get your shopping cart, you pick up your products from the various vendors that you want, and you pay in one place, and then we reimburse the vendors. And then on a Sunday, it's moved to Sunday now, and Sunday you drive over to Cariodos in Green Island on the AD Cahos Avenue, and the market staff will run out and put the groceries in your trunk of your car.
Brilliant. Well, it's looking forward to Saturday. Are the hours any different than they have been, or is it still 9 to 2?
No, we have gone, we're going from 8:30 to 3. We've extended another hour and a half. The first hour of the market, we're hoping to reserve for the elderly, first responders, and people with immune-compromised situations. So we would ask people to respect that. And then the idea of going to 3 is that, you know, because we have a capacity issue, we want to try and prolong the opportunity for customers to come. So we'll see how that works.
Okay. Well, then what's next in store for the market? You're hopefully expanding, or...?
So next in store is to encourage more of our vendors to be in the online market so that people can shop there. If they don't want to go to if they can't get in, or they don't want to go to this outdoor market. And then with the outdoor market, every week we'll be reviewing what happened and how well it went, and see if we can get more vendors back in and more customers in each week.
Well, fantastic. Pretty good. Thanks, Steve, so very, very much. And I'll see you Saturday at the market.
Great. Thank you so much.
And that was HMM's correspondent, Andrea Cunliffe, bringing us up to date with Steve Ryder, manager of the Troy Waterfront Farmers Market, which is opening this Saturday at its new location, First and Division. That concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Michelle.
And I'm Alexis, co-host and engineer. Remember to tune in every weekday to get your daily dose of local news. You can also find that dose on demand through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments, suggestions, or a tender confession, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org.
And until next time, thanks for tuning in.